are ready to proceed. Before I start the clock, though, Ms. Tohali, I don't know if you've heard my comments to prior counsel, but you've reserved five. At the end, I'll interject if I hear the tone to just remind you. Between the government and Nucor, of course, you can split it up any way you want, but at the end of 15, you'll have to wrap up. Everybody clear?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, swell. Ms. Dohali, let's get going.
All right. Good morning, and may it please the Court. This case is about whether Commerce's decision to resort to total adverse facts available, a tool normally reserved for uncooperative respondents, was a reasonable response to DeAcero's inadvertent, fully corrected mistake.
Ms. Dohali, let's start right there. This is Judge Wallach. When DeAcero submitted its revised cost database to Commerce, it characterized the changes as minor corrections. Nucor argues that an experienced respondent in anti-dumping proceedings like DeAcero knows is well aware that the phrase minor corrections is a term of art and that Commerce has explained that they're not minor when they impact a large quantity of sales or have a significant impact on the margin. Do you agree minor correction is a term of art applicable here?
No, Your Honor. We don't believe that the term minor correction, as Nucor refers to it, is a term of art that's applicable in these circumstances. Minor correction is only a term of art in the narrow context of verification proceedings. And
oh, really?
All of the...
Is it your position...
Yes.
Wait. It's your position that it's only applicable to on-site verification. Can you cite anything to support that?
The cases that Nucor refers this court to in its brief are all Commerce decisions that relate to verification. So during an on-site verification, Commerce personnel visit a
refinery. Wait. I didn't ask you what they cited. Has Commerce ever drawn – you're not going to cite me to anything. Has Commerce ever drawn this distinction between verification and unsolicited supplemental questionnaire responses?
Commerce – no, they haven't specifically drawn this distinction, but it would make no sense for Commerce to apply
– Is there a substantive difference between the two contexts?
Yes, there is. So during a verification proceeding, Commerce has completed its fact-gathering phase of the review, and they're just looking to confirm that the data that respondent previously provided is accurate and as respondent says it is. So in that context, factual information.
Mr. Ali, that's not true. They haven't completed their fact-gathering. They can continue to gather facts. Is that not correct?
Well, they can't accept new factual information is what I meant. So the question of whether or not something is a minor correction in the context of a verification relates to whether or not that information rises to the level of new factual information.
Hang on then. Is it fair to characterize the changes in DeAcero's substantially revised cost database as minor corrections?
Yes. So DeAcero, when it used the term minor correction, was referring to the nature of the error and what it had to do to correct its mistake. So
Wholesale change in data, right?
Right, but the total universe of costs that DeAcero reported didn't change between the initial data set and the revised data set. The only thing that changed was the allocation of one specific type of cost, the steel scrap cost, to particular condom numbers. So in light of that, yes, DSRO reasonably believed that that was a minor correction.
On page 37 of its red brief, Newcourt notes that before Commerce, were you DSRO's counsel there?
No, Your Honor. I was not DSRO's counsel before.
It notes that DSRO acknowledged that it did not initially provide Commerce with a complete explanation, and that the one-sentence statement accompanying its substantial revisions to its cost database, this is unquote, was a more general mm-hmm. answer or explanation. You didn't mention that concession in your brief. Why not?
Yes. So if you look at the context of that statement, DSRO's former counsel did not concede that DSRO did not provide a complete explanation. Specifically, if you look at the transcript from that hearing, and I'm referring to appendix pages 5553 and 5554, it's clear that counsel's statement was a response to Newcourt's arguments immediately prior that the July 2016 correction was unexplained. So DSRO's counsel at the time clarified that the initial submission in July 2016 was not entirely unexplained, but rather that initial explanation was more general and that the additional explanation in the post-preliminary submission was, quote, complete. So
yeah.
In that context, it's clear that the term complete wasn't a concession that the initial response had been incomplete. It was used as a synonym for more details in that case.
Okay. On page 7 of its red brief, Newcourt states that, quote, while you recognized that your revised cost database was unsupported by contemporaneous business documents and reconciliations, you chose instead to rely on the, quote, one sentence explanation in your first supplemental questionnaire. Did you ever provide any contemporaneous business documents or reconciliations to support or explain your revised cost database, and where are they in the record?
So what DSRO provided was responsive to exactly what Commerce asked. And again, in the post-preliminary phase, Commerce asked DSRO for the first time to explain specifically why the cost associated with a particular CONUM number had changed and to provide a so-called CONUM cost buildup. So yes, DSRO did provide that CONUM cost buildup, which linked the cost of that particular product code, that CONA, back to its revised data set. And so that buildup, in other words, indicated that all of DSRO's product-specific costs could be traced back to its Section D data set.
On page 5 of the gray brief, you say that the record, quote, illustrates only that DSRO made an error in its cost database, voluntarily submitted a corrected database, and subsequently provided a full explanation of the nature of the corrections, as well as other supporting evidence, supporting information requested by Commerce. How were DSRO's actions voluntary when it didn't offer any meaningful explanation of its revised cost database until after Newcourt brought the revisions to Commerce's attention?
DSRO's actions were voluntary in the sense that Commerce has not provided any sort of guidance for when parties are supposed to submit corrections if they find them and how the parties are supposed to make those corrections. So DSRO in this case proactively... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said, of course it has provided guidance. There are points at which you can no longer provide corrections.
Yes, that's correct, but that has to do with how close the corrections are to the deadline for the preliminary results. And In this case, DSRO's revisions were submitted months in advance of the preliminary results stage, and they were corrections to its own initial submissions. So DSRO, it acted proactively, and it took the initiative here to, as soon as it recognized this mistake, to correct the mistake and to provide Commerce with all of the information that it needed to not only calculate DSRO's dumping margin, but if it wanted to review the significance of the revisions. So DSRO provided, for example, a list of the specific data fields that had changed so that Commerce could verify exactly what the revisions were. And Commerce,
Council,
of course, had the initial cost database.
Council, on page 30, I'm going to continue with this question, of its brief. The government asserts that your argument that it was contrary to law for Commerce to resort to facts available because the revised cost database was usable is waived because it was only raised before the CIT in a perfunctory manner. Where did you argue this point before the CIT in the record?
So on that point, I would direct this court to DSRO's opening brief before the CIT.
Yeah, give me a page.
Yes, one moment.
Okay,
Your Honor. If we turn, it's at the very end of the appendix.
Just give me a page size and we'll look at it.
Okay.
You want to do that in what responsive time you have left?
Yes. Your Honor, of course, I'm happy to address this fully in the rebuttal phase.
Okay. I'm going to ask my brethren if they have any questions. But since this is the last case, we can be a little lax.
No.
Okay. Then let's hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. On behalf of the United States, Commerce's determination to apply total adverse facts available here is supported by substantial evidence. The initial questionnaire from Commerce specifically asked the parties to provide their actual costs, and it also said that if the party did not track actual costs, it asked for a series of databases and information describing the way that the company actually tracked their costs. In response to that questionnaire in February of 2016, DeSero stated on no fewer than four occasions in that questionnaire response that the cost database it was submitting were based on actual costs. And for the court's reference, that's appendix page 117, appendix page 148, appendix page 149, and appendix page 150. And in addition to indicating that it was providing actual costs, in response to the question about cost variances, if you don't track actual costs, DeSero responded, there's no need for us to answer this question. We are providing you actual costs. It wasn't until July of 2016, so several months later, that DeSero provided the updated cost of production database. The only explanation that DeSero accompanied with that database, as the court has noted, was three sentences, essentially saying that these are minor corrections made to the sales and cost database, and then two sentences saying we've corrected the assignment of steel scrap, and a statement about the fields that were impacted by this. That was the entirety of the response from DeSero. I think it bears noting that in response to another supplemental questionnaire, again, not specifically about this cost database, but something unrelated, DeSero in September of 2016 noted that Nucor had flagged the distinct differences between the two databases that had been submitted. and acknowledged that Nucor's argument that they had failed to explain the scope of the differences. And in their response, essentially say, quip, to the contrary, we did respond, and then repeated just those same two sentences again. And that appears on appendix page 5501. Commerce issued a post-preliminary supplemental questionnaire right after the preliminary determination was issued in November of 2016. Then the response from DeSero was received on November 25th of that year, and there, for the very first time, a full 9 months after it had submitted its initial cost of production database, DeSero indicated that that initial database, notwithstanding the repeated statements that it was based on actual costs, was in fact based on planned costs, and that the secondary database was the one that was based on actual costs. And I'm quoting specifically here from the questionnaire response received by DeSero, saying, quote, in other words, steel scrap costs are now based on actual, not planned production. And that language is in the appendix at page 915. Based on this information, Commerce determined that the cost of production database and the cost and value database could not be used. Contrary to the assertions made by DeSero in its opening and reply brief, Commerce's determination not to use the information was not because it was deemed to be untimely. The database was submitted in July, but rather it was because once the actual scope of difference between the two databases was revealed for the very first time by DeSero, a full 9 months after it had been received, Commerce determined that it could no longer rely on either of those databases, and then made the second additional determination that DeSero, by virtue of evidently having at the very latest noticed the problems with its initial submission in July, had failed to fully explain the difference between those until it had been given multiple opportunities to do so, and then finally revealed them in November. And just to briefly touch on a couple points raised in DeSero's reply brief, there's an assertion that Commerce, that the government and the trial court are relying on post hoc statements of counsel as opposed to actual findings made by Commerce with regard to a failure to actually cooperate and behave to the best of their ability. I would refer the court specifically to the IDM, which is in the appendix at page 1032-34, where Commerce did actually, in fact, make a specific finding that DeSero had, quote, significantly impeded the proceeding by failing to identify the scope of the initial error in the initial database, and then not revealing the actual difference between the two databases until after the post-preliminary had been issued. If there's no questions on that issue, I will briefly touch on the corroboration. So Commerce selected, in accordance with Commerce's practice, it selected from among the highest rate alleged in the petition, or in the highest weighted average calculated rate for any respondent in the investigation, and selecting from adverse facts available. Here, it selected a 40% rate based on the petition in this matter, and DeSero was, and Commerce was given the opportunity to, on remand, to further substantiate the selection of this rate. And in the remand redetermination, Commerce placed significant information on the record underlying the rationality of its decision to use this information. Specifically, Commerce placed on the record information. Yes.
This is Judge Wallach. I do have a question for you.
Certainly.
Does Commerce use the term minor correction?
They do, Your Honor, yes. And Commerce did not necessarily make a finding with regard to it being a term of art or not. It is, as counsel for DeSero indicated, it is a term that is used in verifications. It is also used in the context of responses. And again, Commerce did note the use of that term and found that it was part of the reason for applying adverse facts available, not because it's a term of art that they had technically used incorrectly, but rather by explaining the updated database in July by just saying it's minor and providing two sentences explaining the differences. It had not allowed Commerce to appreciate the scope of the changes, and had not afforded Commerce an opportunity to further dig into the changes between the databases.
Okay.
But it is certainly a term Commerce uses.
Thank you.
And so with regard to the corroboration, Commerce placed all of the information from the petition on the record. In addition, Commerce placed a memorandum to file where talking about how Commerce had interviewed the actual market researcher who had obtained the home market price quotes that were contained in the actual petition, in addition to an ex parte memorandum to file in which Commerce is interrogating the information that had been placed on the record by the petitioner, discussing questions regarding affidavits and the foreign market research that was actually contained into supplement. In addition to all of this information that was placed on the record, Commerce also took a look at DeSero's transaction-specific margins from the immediately preceding review and determined that a non-insignificant portion of them were, and I can't use the number, unfortunately, Your Honor, because of CPI, but a non-insignificant portion of them were either at or significantly several times higher than the 40% rate that Commerce had determined. And this is in accordance with statute 1677E(b)(2) specifically contemplates that the petition can be a source for adverse facts available rate. 1677EC says that Commerce must corroborate it, but says that it must be corroborated to the extent practicable. So we would submit that the corroboration that is placed on the record by Commerce, in addition, the step of comparing the selected rate to DeSero's margins on specific transactions in the immediately preceding review, more than meets the requirements of the statute. Unless there are any questions from the panel, I will yield the remainder of my time. And requested the court sustain the trial court's determination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Holt.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Derek Holt on behalf of Newport Corporation. I would like to point the court's attention to two issues related to Commerce's application of adverse inferences. The first one is that while Nippon's best of its ability standard does not require findings of motivation or intent, Commerce did find that DeSero misrepresented and mischaracterized information that it provided to a government agency. And that's at the appendix page 1032 and 1033. So, while DeSero attempts to downplay Commerce's actual findings, you have substantial evidence that DeSero misrepresented the magnitude of the changes made to its database and mischaracterized the changes made to its database as mine. The second thing that I would like to point the court's attention to is that there's substantial evidence that the adverse inferences are warranted because DeSero wasn't forthcoming with its responses. As the government explained, DeSero made substantial changes to the cost of the condom that comprised the overwhelming vast majority of its U.S. sales. And the exact figures are confidential, but they're at Newport's brief at page 28. When you look at those figures, you can see that the cost decline is significant. And it is undisputed that DeSero at all times knew the reason why it allocated a significant portion of its cost away from the condom in question. DeSero had at least two opportunities prior to the preliminary determination to explain why Commerce made why it made these changes, but chose not to do so. So if you want to look at whether DeSero was forthcoming with its explanations, I say you don't have to look any further to DeSero's former counsel, who stated at Commerce's hearing, when we explained the correction initially, we gave kind of a more general answer or explanation. What they said with those three sentences was a general answer. It was not a full and a complete answer. Last thing I would just say is that substantial evidence shows that DeSero wasn't forthcoming with its explanation or why it made the change in the first place. And I'll ask the court to affirm Commerce's determination and apply AFA and assign DeSero a margin of 40.52%. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Mr. Hawley, you asked for rebuttal time, and I ate up all your time. I'll give you 3 minutes.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. And I did want to pick up and address the point regarding DeSero's argument that because Commerce did use DSRO's revisions in the preliminary results, it was obligated to explain why that data became unusable. And I do want to mention the statutory provision that creates this obligation for Commerce, and that is at 19 U.S.C. section 1677M, subsection D. And that requires Commerce, first of all, to promptly inform a person submitting a response with a deficiency as to the nature of the deficiency. But more importantly here, it instructs Commerce to, or and subsection E instructs Commerce that it shall not decline to consider information that's submitted as long as it meets certain applicable requirements. And one of those requirements is that the information can be used without undue difficulties. So to answer your question, if you look at DSRO's opening brief before the CIT, and this is at Appendix 5537 and 5538 specifically, it starts out by discussing, of course, that Commerce found the specific reallocation of billet costs unreliable, but it doesn't really explain why that means that all of the data DSRO provided is unusable. And at the top of page 5538, DSRO argues, finally, given that Commerce had no problem relying on the revisions to calculate a margin for the preliminary results, it is undisputed that the information may be used without undue difficulties. Commerce had no reason not to rely on this information and erred in refusing to do so. So what the government refers to as this usability argument is really related to Section 1677M and the requirement that Commerce consider information, even if there's some issues with it, provided the information cannot be used without undue difficulties.
Yeah, is that it, counsel?
Yes, that's our argument. And again, it's a statutory argument. It's based in Commerce's obligations under 1677M.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hawley. And I just comment as an aside that your argument reminds me of Prime Minister Churchill's naming in 1940 of Operation Wilfred. You might look it up. It was named Wilfred because it was so minor and inoffensive. That was a cartoon character who had those characteristics. Thank you. The matter will stand submitted. That concludes cases for the day.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.